who don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 348, and you know what? We staying out late. It's your host. You love him. You know him. It's Everybody Way. And in the booth with him are his friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have an amazing critic, an amazing Christmas daddy, and a just amazing all-around author, person. Got a nice, fancy, sexy new book on the way, and you can hear his voice reading it. It's Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
First of all, what's good is that I think you just forgot your own name for a second, where we've all been there in front of an open mic, so I no shade at all. It humanizes you in my eyes, because I feel better knowing that it's not just me. What's good this week, you can file this under I'm old, but I have recently discovered that support socks are really great. They just give you that little bit of massage going on in your lower legs and your ankles. And I'm a fan. I am not so old that when summer comes around, I'm going to wear them with shorts. That moment of my life will come, I'm sure, but we're not there yet. But for now, I'm still in a long pant mode. I'm enjoying some support socks. If you're walking, if you're standing, they really just give you a little bit of circulation that you might otherwise not have.
Alonzo, I'm sorry, I got to jump on this. You know, obviously anything in this realm I love. And I, a few years ago, got these things. They're like copper compression sleeves. They look like the wristbands like for like John McEnroe in the day. But you put them around the like meat of your foot, the arch of it, and they feel so good. Like it's that same, it's like a squeeze, but it's not the hot whole sock. Anyway, yep.
So like I'm a very also low old. Leg warmer.
a very like 3-inch leg warmer for the meat of your foot. All right. This has been our weekly old person talk.
Yeah,
you're welcome. You know,
podiatry edition.
Yeah. Well, you know, just switching it up for the first time. Usually she's talking about the face. Now she's talking about the feet and the wrist. It is none other than the Queen of the Midwest herself, Super Festival programmer, producer, Drea Clark. What's good?
Please continue to think of me in the skincare realm and not the foot realm. I beg of you. I beg of you. When this episode comes out, the what's really good with me and what's been like taking over my life for the last few months, we announced our lineup for Bentonville Film Festival. And I've been working on it for so long, and this is my first year. I've been the film curator forever. It's my first year as artistic director. Really proud of our lineup. Smart eyes, eagle eyes will notice I have many exciting Sundance titles in there. Our opening night film, Out of My Mind, is directed by my friend Amber Seeley, and I actually produced a previous film of hers. And our whole focus at Bentonville is on representation and inclusion in interesting ways, both in front and behind the camera. I think Out of My Mind is a terrific example of that. It's an adaptation of a novel by Sharon M. Draper, of whom I'm also a huge fan. And the lead actress, Phoebe Ray Taylor, is a wheelchair user with cerebral palsy, and the story is about that. And they did like such conscious effort of casting and then working with people behind the scenes in the disability community, and that's exciting. I'm also showing I'm showing some of my favorites. I'm showing Ghostlight, which I adored, which is by alumni filmmakers. I also showed St. Francis by them a few years ago. There's a film called Dandelion by Nicole Regal that I think is really special. I'm super excited. There's a couple documentaries. Oh, no, there's many. There's many. You're going to love all of our films. But I have a film actually that premiered at South By called We Can Be Heroes, which is a really charming about kids at a LARP camp. And a lot of them are like neuroatypical and queer. And it's like the place they feel safe. And I loved it. I'm showing Daughters from Sundance, which I also think was special. If you're wondering if everything made me cry, it did. But what doesn't at this point? So... anyway, Bentonville, check it out. We will have virtual screenings available. Festival's in June. Don't worry. You'll hear about it as much as you hear about Alonzo's book.
Good, because I want to hear about it. Oh, wow. Well, you know who else I like hearing about? Well, it's our returning guest, who is amazing, a film critic, esteemed like all of the film critics we have here, Robert Daniels. What's good?
Woo-hoo! Thanks for having me again. If you'd asked me yesterday, I'd have been like, the sun is out in Chicago in April, which is rare. But now we have fog, so that kind of sucks. But last night...
Is it true that like when the sun appears, everybody just peels their shirt off because yes. they're dying for vitamin D?
Oh, no. Everyone last night was in shorts, crop tops. Chicago during April is wild if we get like mid-60s.
It's where the Midwestern dad really shines and they start wearing like the shorts, but then they'll begrudgingly put on their like padded windbreaker. Because then it gets too cold, but they're unwilling to let go of that they've already turned the corner to spring. Love it.
Last night, my partner, Mariah E. Gates, she's been back from California for about a week. And we finally celebrated my birthday almost 2 months late because she's been in Northern California for about 2 months or so. So we had a great Italian dinner at Italian Village last night.
Ooh.
You, happy birthday late. Mariah is incredible and will hopefully be a guest of ours someday. She's another amazing freelance film writer, and I'm a big fan. But also, I really like the implications that maybe you've sort of messed with your zodiac sign in some way. Like, you're, like, throwing off all predictions of what your year is by celebrating your birthday in a whole different month.
Yeah, no, it almost feels like a whole different year, actually, at this point.
Truly. Well, you've been in like 5 countries since then, too.
Yeah, on my way to another pretty soon with Can.
Since COVID, time means nothing.
Yeah, I know.
It's all we can good. All agree on
what's
that.
What's time?
Yeah, if you start something.
What's good?
What's good? If he's also holding the most beautiful cat, I'm so jealous. Trillian, you come here right now.
Yeah. Tuna decided that he wants to be a pod lap cat. Usually, Puar will be on the lap. Charlie likes doing her own thing. But Tuna now, he's like, oh, I saw Puar in your lap, so now I want to come. You know, just like sibling energy all the time. What's good with me is I went to the Ren Fair yesterday, which is why my voice is slowly kind of recovering. But last year was the first time I went, and this year I got like super dressed up. You know, I had like this like barbarian-esque situation with the lacrosse chest harness with the like shoulder cape and the like pirate pants and the boots. And it was really cool. And I remember I was like, all I need to really bring this together is a big sword. I wish I had a big sword like Guts from Berserk. And of course, as soon as I walk in, there's a man holding a big wooden sword. And I was like, yep, I'm about to buy it.
Really hope that what you did at the Ren Fair was regale them all with your perfect accent work.
Oh, yes.
That's one of my favorite Ren Fair details.
Well, it was funny because I would talk like this to different people. I'm a barbarian, so really, I don't know why I'm...
a Scottish Nigerian.
Yeah. One second, I would like a spot of mead as we traverse the Ren Fair.
He can't do the Nigerian accent. That's the one he does well.
Oh, true.
I have to switch it up.
Nothing feels more right for me than you walking around with one of those big-ass turkey legs, so. I have to hope that happened.
Oh, you know it did, and now they cover it with sauce, so we had it with garlic parmesan sauce, and I gotta say, that was the last missing piece of the big turkey leg puzzle. So we had a bunch of that, had a bunch of friends, we were marched with Mallory, was going around, lifting people up, M had her like little Red Riding Hood, so that's good. And then after that, I had a show at the Comedy Store last night, and everyone kept saying, I hope you go on stage like that. I hope you go on stage. they were that close to getting it going. But then to bring it full circle, it's exciting. I bumped into Dan Van Kirk, a great comic, a Chicago guy. And he was talking about being in Chicago for a week doing shows. And he was like, if you come, I'll put you up every night. So I think I'm going to be in Chicago for a week in July. Aww. If the stars align, which Chicago's one of my favorite cities that I haven't gotten a taste more of, because I went out there once for a comedy festival
and it was like the best comedy festival experience, and it was the last year they did it. It was so, it was like, oh man, I'm coming back to this festival every year, and they're like, that was the last one.
Wear the harness, I dare you.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, so you know, hopefully, I mean, if you're in town, I'll get to see Robert. We'll be IRL. Maybe we'll go to that Italian restaurant. I mean, I got restaurant hit lists now with this Top Chef season, you know, going off. Suan, if there's any Top Chef heads, Suan, he's a Chicago guy. Okay, final thing. I'm sorry, Marissa, because this is, but I'm LA born and raised, so like my perception of distance between states are so, it's funny how different it is, because in Top Chef, they're in Wisconsin, and he was like, oh yeah, I know Suan from Chicago. And I was like, oh, how does he go to Chicago? He was like, oh, you can bike from Wisconsin to Chicago. I was like, oh, and then we looked it up, and the distance from like Wisconsin to Chicago is shorter than LA to San Diego.
Yeah. Why do you think we in Wisconsin we refer to them as fibs?
Fibs.
fucking Illinois bastards coming up, soaking up all the cabins.
Oh man, yeah. So hopefully I'll do that bike ride one when I'm in Chicago. Just go to Milwaukee and back, and see all that. But I felt comfortable spending so much time talking about Chicago because we're headed to 92 in Cabrini Green for We Grown Now, and then we'll have a hotline call about short films, plus an update on the Hall of Excellence. But first, it's time for Itadic, our movie news segment, which stands for Is This Important? Do I Care? Where we read the week's movie news and answer that very question. So Alonzo, you want to go ahead and kick this off?
Oh, it would be my pleasure. Jennifer Aniston is producing a remake of 9 to 5. The latest film to get the remake treatment is coming courtesy of Aniston's Echo Films. Of course, the original 9 to 5 was released in 1980, starred Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and making her big screen debut, Dolly Parton, as office employees plotting revenge against a sexist boss and, you know, the patriarchy in general. A reboot or sequel to the hit film has been in various phases of development for ages. This latest remake announcement comes with few additional details, except that Diablo Cody is working on the script. Is this important? Do you care?
Before we even get started, I need to ask a very important question, which is the Dolly Parton song based off the movie, or was it?
It was written for the film.
Oh, it was okay.
When you get where you grab your cup of ambition,
yeah. So that being said, then does this mean that we have to get the Beyonce version? Because I fuck with Beyonce's Jolene. It is so like. Dolly already said she liked it, but it's so funny seeing people being like, "Oh, the Dolly." But I'm like, no, this is a good anyway.
Yeah, I think Beyonce's 9 to 5 would have to be from the CEO's point of view, which is a whole other thing. But you know, we'll see what we get. This is a property that it spawned a sitcom that lasted for several seasons. It's been a Broadway musical. But the thing is, the concerns raised in 9 to 5 are still very much present in the workplace in terms of discrimination and inequality and exploitation. So you
could. And casual sexual harassment.
Yeah. Heaven knows that never goes out of style. So, I think the thing is, like, do we have to call it 9 to 5, or can we just make an original workplace comedy that perhaps centers on three women and, you know, addresses the same issues? And then that way it doesn't have to be scrutinized in the original did the blah, 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 you know? So
If Jennifer Aniston is going to give away the cultural cachet of releasing something called 9 to 5, you're crazy.
I guess. I just, you know, again, I always believe don't remake the movies that worked, remake the ones that didn't, you know? And the Diablo Cody of it, I have to say, of her films, I much prefer her dealing with women in middle age, basically. I think like Tully and young adult have been some of her stronger works of late. I'm less into, you know, horror occult Diablo Cody, and maybe that's just me. So if you're going to tell me she's working on something, I'm more interested in hearing that it's something like this than another Lisa Frankenstein.
I think the part of it. I'm excited about the Diablo Cody for the same reason you are. I haven't seen Ricky in the Flash, so I can't speak to her entire. Oh God,
was that her
cornucopia of okay, there goes middle-aged that women? But she did that whole series,
United States of Terra.
United States of Terra, not Tess. And I do think, first off, please go rewatch 9 to 5 or watch it for the first time if you haven't. Mm. It does hold up. And it's also when you rewatch it, you're like, oh, this thing is so much darker than I remembered. It's literally about them plotting the death of their boss. But Diablo, I think there's potential for fantasy sequences in there, like revenge fantasies. I don't know. There's ways where she could really cook. The casting of this they've tried to do this forever. Who knows if this will actually come to fruition, but people will play cast this thing who doesn't want to cast 9 to 5?
It's kind of the other Valley of the Dolls in terms of movies about three women that they've been threatening to remake for decades and it never happens. But it is fun to speculate which of the contemporary crop of actresses would be the ones to play these roles.
Yeah.
I don't think you could even call it 9 to 5 sounds utopian. It should be called 9 to 9 because that's actual work.
I was just gonna say you wish.
I was trying to think what's the gig economy version of 9 to 5? 9 to 5 and then to your 5 to 9.
And no OT.
Yeah. Oh, that's a bummer. Speaking of movies, French TV viewers will get a very short chance to see this year's Cannes Film Festival through the eyes of Messi, the canine star of last year's Anatomy of a Fall, which we covered on this here podcast. In a slightly baffling announcement, festival producers said last week that Messi, the Cannes Film Festival from a Dog's Eye View, that's the title, will be a series of 8 1-minute episodes to be broadcast simultaneously on 4 French national TV channels during this year's festival. According to the press release, this will be an opportunity for Messi to ask his guest any questions with the innocence of a dog. Is this important? Do you care?
This is another question I'm going to start this off with. Do the French have the same...
Can Messi speak?
Yeah, well, that I guess is my second one. But do the French have the same obsession with dogs and pet cultures that Americans do?
Way more.
Way more.
You they can were taking bring their a dogs dog into inappropriate places into way before.
Any place. Yeah. There's no this one's pet friendly. It's all dog friendly. Bring your dog. French women invented the ultimate aspiration is a Birkin with a Pekingese in it.
This is about to be a smash.
Well, a thing I learned, I've been watching the French sitcom Call My Agent on Netflix, which is hilarious. And I'm shocked there hasn't been an American version yet, because apparently there have been other countries have been doing their own versions all over the globe. But the Cannes Film Festival is televised in France. When whoever's giving the big opening, welcome speech or whatever, it's on TV. It'd be like if here, Robert Redford's annual invocation, whatever the speech he gives at the beginning of the Sundance Film Festival, if that aired somewhere, that's how seriously and tied into the Cannes Film Festival they are over there. So they've obviously got to come up with new ways to jazz it up every year. And so, yeah, I think having a dog asking questions on the red carpet for 1 minute shorts is kind of brilliant, because this is really, I think, France's greatest dog star since the one in The Artist, Uggie.
Well, for me, 1 minute is the exact amount it needs to be.
For sure.
You're like, right before it's about to wear off, bam, we're...
I kind of hope that the French, instead of having a Beyonce or Taylor Swift beat, has a Messi beat. They have one French reporter just following Messi everywhere.
Honestly, I would just watch them interview Messi.
Yeah.
8 times for 1 minute. That dog, again, go watch Anatomy of a Fall for many reasons. That dog's performance in it.
Yeah.
Truly troubling to this day. Thrilled he's still alive and interviewing.
Yes. Speaking of movies, Hollywood sacrificing massive profits through racial inequality. According to the latest McKinsey report, the decision makers in Hollywood seem to have it exactly backwards when it comes to centering diverse actors. For the third year in a row, analysts estimated how much potential revenue studios have passed up by not being racially inclusive. This year, that tally came to a whopping $30 billion. The estimate factors in the spending power of several different demographics and how many respondents say they'd be willing to spend more money on content that reflects their lives. Is this important? Do you care?
This is our other sign that we tap, right? Like we tap the physical media sign, and I feel like there's variations of this, either racial inequality, gender representation, sexuality. Like, there's so many things.
Queer inclusion.
Yeah, that when it comes down to like the idea of it being a financial thing, it's like an even bigger sign. Like I have many reasons why it is a huge, you know, focus of my life and my career in terms of this kind of representational storytelling. But the money part of it is like, don't quit hitting yourself.
Yeah.
Quit hitting yourself.
You know, a movie like Black Panther or Barbie or whatever, like makes massive amounts of money. And still for so many in the industry, it's just it's a fingers in the ear. La, 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 la. I can't hear you moment. And yeah, it's like no one's expecting that you're going to do the right thing for the right reason, but they wouldn't even do the right thing for the wrong reason, which is to like, you know, boost their bottom line.
This one of the statistics I'm looking at here, the eye popping $12 billion to $8 billion lost in not properly valuing Latino professionals and consumers. That starts on every level, because on a festival level, that is an area that is hard for me to program every year. I'm looking all year for work by Latinx filmmakers who are American. Like, you can find people who are like working in their country of origin, but, and it means that those filmmakers, they're out there. It means they're having the same grind of finding financing, of having their stories. And because of that, then they're not being broken as talent that can then be, you know, like moved along and whatever. And there's audiences for it at every level. $12 billion is the low end of what they're missing out on.
Well, that. 18. Like, there's every year these surveys come out and they're like, the most dedicated movie going like butts and seats audience in this country is Latinos. And yet, God forbid, we make some films that might appeal to that community directly and also have other communities that want to see them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so many things coming together in this. I think one is the thing we always say when a like diverse film comes out and it does really well, and they're like, "Whoa, who could have predicted this?" And we're like, "We've been saying this for years." And then I think the other side of it is the things that I've been like kind of talking about bubbling up, which is this like DEI, you know, placeholder scare, and them trying. And I like that, you know, we're bringing the facts out against them. So I think it is very important for things like this to come out to show the actual facts and show the data and not let, you know, the talking heads talk out their ass. So how about you stay right there so we can talk about this movie and not out our ass, because we're going to be right back. But when we come back, we're talking We Grown Now.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, if you want it way. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Robert Daniels,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today's movie premiered at last year's Toronto Film Festival and is the third from writer-director Minhal Baig. Alongside its leads, child actors like Blake Cameron James and Gian Knight Ramirez, it stars Journey Smollett, Essie Pathan Murchison, and Lil Rel Howery. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of We Grown Now?
Sure. It's the early 90s, and it's the we're in the Cabrini Green housing development in Chicago, which had not yet been demolished. And our leads are Malik and Eric. They're best friends, and they are best friends in that way that little kids are. And that friendship, obviously, while central to their lives, is somewhat under fire now because circumstances in the neighborhood is leading Malik's mother and grandmother to think about possibly getting out of Cabrini Green and moving somewhere nearby that offers not only economic opportunities for the mom, but also a safer environment for the kids, further away from gangs and crime. And so the two of them have to figure out what is to become of their friendship when they are being ripped apart by forces beyond their control. It is very intimately about kids and friendship and families and the circumstances of youth and the larger world around them. We grown now.
Oh, that was great. You know, I'm going to, you know, read this and then, like, you know, extrapolate on it. You'll see what I mean. So, you know, Marissa started it off with this great question. What did you know about the Cabrini Green before seeing this film, and did watching it change your perspective? So I grew up in Compton, and I even knew about Cabrini Green. I feel like there are, like, projects that are, like, widely known, I guess, in the zeitgeist, either through, like, hip hop and rap, or just, you know, through meeting people from, like, these areas. And so, like, the big ones out here was Nickerson Gardens, which I actually grew up next to and my stepmom worked with. And then I know there's the Marcy Projects. And then there's, I keep forgetting the one in Louisiana, but that's the one Lil Wayne is from. And the reason I mention that is that they all kind of have just this exterior kind of perception as, like, oh, this is a place where, like, crime happens. And I think part of it comes from people using it as their street cred. And the other part of it is just the perception of Black poverty and what it means to be in this, like, state housing. And it's what I like about this movie is it, by zeroing in on these kids, it focuses on the people and not the perception. And it kind of reminds, I think, hopefully anyone who watches it, that no matter what the perception is, it's its people, which is one of, like, the closing lines. But I kind of do want to quickly as possible hand it over to Robert, because you're from Chicago, right?
I am from Chicago. Yeah. And my half sister actually grew up in Cabrini Green. And I grew up by the Henry Horner Homes, which is the West Side Projects. So a lot of my friends live there. So I remember visiting very often the Henry Horner Homes, which is like visiting a different world. But Cabrini Green was the same way. And most of it's gone. Only the row houses, so the not the like the high rises, those were torn down decades ago now. But the low kind of row houses are still there. Cabrini Green, of course, gained prominence through the original Candyman, which was all filmed there. And then later on, the remake of Candyman actually filmed in the remnants of Cabrini Green in the row houses. But yeah, I just thought, I saw We Grown Out back at TIFF and absolutely loved this film so much. And I think it really recaptures the essence of those high rises. And you mentioned, like, community, right? About how, like, community is made up of its people. And how these projects, when they were first built in the early 50s, I want to say, really were supposed to be these community areas, and how much, like, they declined through disenfranchisement and disinvestment. And so, yeah, I mean, I absolutely love this film, and it felt so Chicago, and in a way that, like, a lot of Chicago films, it's like, you know, they'll do a couple of inserts of, like, downtown skyline, we're in Chicago, yay, and that's kind of it. But Min Hall,
shot of the river,
yes. But Min Hall, like, really took, I think, she's from Chicago, she's from Rogers Park neighborhood, really took care to, I think, make a Chicago film that felt very textured and very, I think, lived in. And the Cabrini Green segments in particular feel that way.
I love the sort of the intersection of those two ideas, one of the things Iffy said in terms of the focus of people on this and specifically the children, and then also what that means to a sense of space, because this movie is so beautifully captured from a childlike point of view. Like, Pat Scola shot this. He's the cinematographer, did the most incredible work, was nominated for a Spirit Award for it. We've talked previously, I love the movie Pig that he shot as well, that I'm sure I didn't shut up about ever. But part of, you know, how this is framed, it's also that idea of where you grow up, that's your normal. So, like, these kids aren't growing up like, oh, we live, you can be both cognizant of the place you live and maybe how it's seen or how you're seen, but it doesn't necessarily mean that is your filter for how you see your life. And these kids are like kids. They're finding fun where they can. They're finding dreams where they can. There's a lot of little moments of play. And the two young actors who played the best friends, Malik and Eric, I was like, oh, I don't know how they cast two best friends, because it was that kind of like, that felt as lived in as this place, like these two boys who are together all day, every day, which many people have a best friend, especially around that age, that you like have a codependent relationship on. That's just your person. You're just with them constantly. Everybody knows that your friend is like a few inches from you. And the other part that they do really well is show a couple of, like, we see the parents that they're talking about, and they're both single parent families for different reasons. And they are also both very loving, committed, and complex families. Like, it's not giving you that wash. Normally, if you're like, oh God, do I want to see something set in 1992 in Cabrini Green? Like, the dad's going to be a drug dealer who doesn't care about the kids. You know, I'm just expecting all of these tropes. These are just as believable, and it is that rich texture of a place that makes it so real, and that the parents are worried about everything. They're worried about whatever, but they're also like aware of how they're being treated by the police presence that starts to show up. Like, it's not just a submissive, like, oh yes, they're fighting back in ways, but it's also a lot of it is just like, there's no lift out of this. How do I do this? How do I navigate this? And I loved all of the small questions it brought up in a really kind of flowing, lyrical way.
It reminded me of, there was a really great HBO miniseries a couple years ago called Show Me a Hero that was about it was based on a true story about the sort of creation of these housing developments in Newark. And it really kind of took you into like the political aspect of it and the people who live there and then the people, you know, who live nearby who were worried about it. Like, Catherine Keener plays this character who's your sort of classic, you know, not in my backyard sort of homeowner. And there's this great scene where she and a bunch of other like white ladies from the neighborhood actually go in and visit with one of the residents of, you know, somebody who's in one of the projects who would be put into one of these new homes that's being built. And she is kind of gobsmacked to see like framed photos of the family on the wall. And like when her host is giving everybody tea, like she sees that one of the tea cups has a little chip in it and makes sure to keep that one for herself and give the good one to Catherine Keener. Like, it's just blowing her mind that it's not this, like, that there's just not, you know, garbage cans with fire coming out of them at every corner, you know? And so, yeah, I do love that this movie sort of humanizes, like, these are kids, these are families, this is where they live, and they aren't living their lives like, ah, I'm embattled in this housing project. It's like, I have to go to work and make sure you get to school on time, and did you do your homework yet, and here's what's for dinner. Like, you know, I loved being plunged into that in such a way and having it be anchored by the two kids, because the performances are so natural. And I mean, I think one of my favorite kinds of film is, and it's usually autobiographical, when a filmmaker will do a movie about their own childhood. Like, I'm one of the people that Crooklyn is my favorite Spike Lee movie. You know, I love Amarcord and Radio Days. And like, there's a lot of different, you know, films where directors kind of will portray what their own childhood was like. And this isn't that, but it has that same sense of immediacy.
Yes.
Yeah. It very much reminded me of, you know, it's not blaxploitation at all. It very much reminded me of stuff like Cooley High and Claudine, the kind of the softer side. And of course, not blaxploitation, but also reminded me, of course, as Crooklyn, which was a big influence on this film. I interviewed Min Hall 6 months ago about this film, and she talked about how much Glenn was such a big, 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 big influence in terms of how they captured this childhood.
I do like the kids' performances in this and what that means to the childhood. There's also that if you watch a bunch of things, there's that real like tightrope between a kid who's like professional and getting there and getting his lines and has that like, I'm delivering my line like this. These two, well, all of the kids in this, and they're beautifully cast and beautifully shot, but they're so present and in moments, and it allows for that real immersion in that child experience that I loved. And what Alonzo's talking about, the attention to detail of like this also, you're in this hallway and they took the time to get these shots that are just like, oh, I'm taking in both that this entire building interior is cinder block, which is wild to look at, but it is dressed by this family with like photo frames and all the things you'd see in any drywalled house that you're maybe used to. And that kind of dissonance between the materials and how they're treated is just this perfect example of what this movie is trying to give you in terms of that fear. It's funny because we're a minute into this and it's like, oh, I wonder, they haven't really gotten to what the story's about yet. And that's sort of part of it because you are much more experiencing primarily Malik. Malik is our main voice, but again, Eric's right there. But you're primarily just experiencing what they're experiencing. So again, in that kid-like way, the major story points are kind of happening a little over their heads. One of their classmates from a different class is, you know, there's an act of violence in the middle of it that sort of sets off some kinds of things, but it's all really done through this fascinating filter of like what kids would be aware of for stories. So it's not like, oh, and then there was an inciting incident at page 17 and then it made them do this. Like those things are happening. And like the mom's job thing, like their lives are filtering around, but it is not like, it's not Stand By Me, right? It's not, right. You guys want to go on this hike and find a dead body? Like
I was reminded of like Richard Linklater's Apollo 10 and a half, which a movie that I adored. And I think it kind of fell by the wayside because it was Netflix sort of buried it. But you know, we talked about, like, if you're a kid in the late 60s, Vietnam is a thing that is happening on television, you know, but you don't really aren't grasping it in a direct way, you know. And it's like, yeah, sometimes, you know, you're in your kid world and you've got your kid concerns and things are, you know that they're being talked about, you know, they're sort of happening out there somewhere, but they don't touch you necessarily. And so you don't really, they aren't factoring in your day to day.
I do love that they are aware of it, like above and beyond, you know, they end up going to a funeral at one point. Like they're aware very closely of some of the things happening. And then some of them they're just referencing, like this kid is showing off like this blinged out watch, I believe would be the 1992 term. And they're super, I say kid and I mean like small child. They're all like, I don't know, children's ages, 9, 10. They're small. They're kids though. And this, he's like, oh, he only earned that because he like looks out on the like corner for his brother. It's like this small illusion of their awareness of things that are going around in their world. But again, they're not looking at it like, oh, isn't it terrible that there's drug dealers like in our, they're like, no, that's his brother. Like that is just something this kid does. And I love the matter of factness that all of those things are woven in.
Yeah, I know. It felt like a very like real kind of just take on it because there's this version, I think, of this life that's often told where like it is something that everyone always kind of like thinks about and that's the life and that's the struggle when really it's like when you're living in it, you build your life around it. It is just the setting, the backdrop of it, and less so this like active force that you're dealing with. And so it felt very real. And then you have those moments like the shooting where it has no choice but to collide and affect your life. And even in that, they're like, you know, this sucks, whatever. And then like they deal with it. They go through that. The kids kind of see the reality in that. And then they just go back to life. And
I was going
to
say, case in point, right after all that happens and the parents are like really concerned about knowing their whereabouts, then they decide they're going to like cut school for a day and take the train downtown. It's like, okay, so this clearly, this message is not getting to you because you're just like, yeah, I'm good. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, and that's what and that was probably the like hardest convo in the movie, because I feel like more so just flashbacks of just that like initial worry, and I just knew it was coming. I was like, oh, as soon as she finds out that he wasn't in danger, there's a whole nother level of heat that's coming. Yeah,
the classic parent thing. Oh my God, are you okay? Are you okay? How dare you?
Yeah, oh yeah, it was that was like a horror movie for me watching that, because I was like, oh, the more you know worried she is, it's just gonna swing back even harder because you had me worried.
did any of you see any of Minhal's previous films? Like, I saw Hala, which I love so much. H-A-L-A. Please check it out if you can. It's with Geraldine Viswanathan. I feel like Alonzo's had to correct me on her name.
Viswanathan, I think, is what
Thank
we
you. I was like, I'm feeling you to tag in and do her right, which I really loved. And it actually was a film that started as a short film, and then she made into a feature and grew. And that one's also set in Chicago, and I think that's Rogers Park, right, Robert? I don't know if you saw Hala.
No, I did. Yeah, I saw Hala at Sundance, and I quite like it as well. And yeah, it is set in Rogers Park. I think all of her films, I think, have been set in Chicago. So she's very much a Chicago filmmaker. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this is, I mean, I really liked Hala. I think this is such a major step forward, not just in the characterizations, but of course, as we've talked about, like the cinematography and the editing and just the command of these characters, it just feels like a major, major, major step forward. And I think also working on a wider canvas, like the trip to the Art Institute that we've kind of referenced, and that being here, taking them out of their milieu and like, so I feel like, especially particularly hood films of the 90s, you know, you would always be kind of trapped in the neighborhood as though like Black people never left their neighborhood. When like, I mean, when I was a kid, we used to
get
on the train all the time and go to the Art Institute. And so I think her work, I think she's like working on this like larger canvas in such a more organic way in this film that feels like just a really, really, really big upgrade from Hala, even though I do really like that film.
And she wrote an episode of BoJack Horseman, so that, for me, cements, you know, she's an icon.
Iffy, you just responded when he said the idea of them being filmed at the Art Institute and, like, not in their normal, you nodded. Was that, like, something that stood out to you?
Yeah, like, I think back of just, I like the kind of, like, the shots of it. And just to me, it just looked very beautiful. It almost felt like in that scene, no one else was moving except them. they were moving about this space, and everything else was frozen in time.
Do you think this is an overt Ferris Bueller's Day Off reference, or is it just that we can't see the Seurat painting in a movie without thinking of Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
I love it. This one, I do appreciate that. I feel Marissa's last question that she gave us as a potential prompt was for me, which is, did you cry? When did you cry and why? You know, I cried. I'm always never not crying.
I have to say, I didn't. And the one beef I have with this movie is that there are some of the big moments that felt too adult screenwriter to me, where like for a movie that's so kids POV, that suddenly like there were these moments of kind of wisdom or something where I was like, this feels like retrospective and not necessarily in the moment, whereas the rest of the movie I think is really great about the in the momentness of it. And so there were a couple of things toward the end where I was like, yeah, and that kept me from bawling, but it definitely, I think if you did it is earned by the film.
Malik wrote something, and I was like, I know many 30-year-olds that are too dumb to write the thing that you just wrote, like this very poetic, like almost philosophical little thing. Me, it was absolutely just a close-up at the end of the two boys, and I had, you guys, not to compare them to Messi, but you know Messi's my favorite performance of the year, but I had the same, like, how did they do that? Like, just, you get a close-up on any human just starting to cry, I'm going to be impressed. You get it with two little kids, and I'm like, those, what? How in the world? So, yeah. I don't know if I might be the only one who teared up, but I won't ever deny it when I do.
I got really, for me, the closest I got was when it was the kind of like poem that he wrote, and his friend, like, get so like just that kind of, because to me, this is such a perfect moment of that specific age. Like when you moved away from a friend at that age, you were like, oh yeah, I'm never going to see you again. It's done here. And so much of our life was together. And I think so much was kind of captured in that exchange, because there's this like discomfort with it, the anger of him moving, but also just like almost this vulnerability. He seemed uncomfortable reading, and then he was like, take this out. Like it seemed like it just covered so much, where like on the surface level just seems like a dispute over, you know, the anger of moving. But to me, I was like, oh, this covers just at that age. It's like, oh no, why are you writing about me like that? You know,
with Drea, I started crying the second I had the close up and we see this embrace between the two of them. I started bawling, especially because I think this film is such an interesting, well, I don't think it was on Minhal's mind that she was making it, but the present reverse migration that's happening out of like the northern kind of Midwestern cities like Chicago and Detroit, of a lot of Black people who are like, you know, who generations ago came up with all these dreams of a, you know, of a better life, and now returning back to the South after being disillusioned, is felt like hit even closer to home, because like I can remember like the west side of Chicago, and so many houses that I used to see friends in are now empty or now empty lots and stuff like that. And it's it really, really hit close to home. So I started bawling the second they said goodbye.
Yes.
Having the grandmother there to provide that history, I think really gives the movie a lot in terms of placing what this family is going through in a larger context, for sure.
Oh, such an astute observation, Alonzo. Like a professional film analyzer.
Yeah, that was a lot of heavy digging to figure that out. You know?
It was still, it's good. It was a genuine compliment. Thank you. Vote!
All right, yes, now we vote. We have, you know, returning guests and all of the OGs are here. But if you're listening for the first time, the way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. Who wants to start?
I'll say screen it, even though with some of the qualms that I had toward the end. It is a beautiful looking film, certainly. The performances are so great. And a lot of it, I think, is really moving and insightful, not just in terms of, like we said, the sort of inner workings of a kid's friendship, but also like the larger, all the characters have their own stuff to deal with. They're not just sort of there to be sounding boards for other characters. Like, you know, Journey Smollett's character has an agenda and an arc, and the grandmother has, you know, her own stuff. And so, yeah, I think all of that is really beautifully captured.
Mm.
I am also a screen it. I think this is a really special film. I would love more people to see it. I think it's such an immersive, experiential, you're in there with it. It's beautiful to look at, as Alonzo said, but it's also that kind of thing of like, yeah, do you want to watch something that gives you maybe the slightest of even fictionalized insights to someone else's life and to how they went through it and at a certain age? And I think everyone can use a little storytelling aided empathy in how they go through the world, and this one's a really beautiful way to do it. I also want to give a nod to that I did cry at the ending, and I also absolutely, it made me think of that part in Good Will Hunting when Ben Affleck's like, every day I come pick you up, and every day I hope you won't be there, and that you instead, like, there's like a speech about what Eric is hoping for Malik, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna tie those two in my head forever. So now I hope anyone watching this after they hear me does the same.
I have a screen it. I think this is an absolutely gorgeous film. And I also just, you know, we've talked about like the kid actors and they're great as well. But Jurnee Smollett in this is really, really great. And I think my one qualm with the film is that she's a little bit too, her character's a little bit too flat. It's a little bit too of a stereotype of that we've seen in plenty of these films. But I think she makes a meal out of it. And same thing with Laurel Howe.
Yes.
I'm never going to get that man's name right.
I want to see him in more dramatic roles now. Yeah. I love a comic actor going dramatic.
Yeah, Laurel Howery. I love him in this. And he doesn't have much screen time, but his impact feels much, much bigger than his screen time. It's just a really strong ensemble doing strong work in a very beautiful film. Drea, I also thought about Good Will Hunting in that scene. But I'm always thinking about Good Will Hunting, so.
Yes.
Iffy, what about you?
I mean, yeah, for me, that's going to be a screen it. I enjoyed it. Had a good time. It looks lovely. And yeah, I think you should just see this pop off on the big screen. So yeah, very good. Very good. And on that note, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
All right, class, tomorrow's exam will cover the extinction and de-extinction of the dodo, PowerPoint as an art form, and the history of Eurovision. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything, where we learn about science and a bit of everything else.
My name's Tom. I studied cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Robert Daniels,
Drea Clark,
and me, Marissa Flaxbart. Hi, everybody. I am here to give you guys the long-awaited results of a recent Hall of Excellence that you guys did on the topic of wordless characters, dialogue-free characters, however right, you want to yes. say it.
I haven't slept a wink. Haven't slept a wink since we did
no.
this.
Oh, yeah. No, that's bad because it's been like 2 weeks.
I know, it's been a rough time.
That we did this back on our Sasquatch Sunset episode with guest Joey Clift. And apologies to guest Joey Clift, who will probably be heartbroken to learn that despite his campaigning, Garfield the cat, his pick, only got 4% of the vote. With 22% of the vote, a big jump up. We have Michael Myers from Halloween, Drea's pick.
Yay.
30% of these votes went to Mr. Bean. That was Iffy's pick.
Nice.
So I'm thrilled to once again give Alonzo the rare win at 44%. Alonzo's pick of Harpo Marx.
Oh, that's awesome. Yes.
I want to shout out a couple of comments that we got. Monsieur Hulot, somebody said.
Yep, good one.
Would have been great. Matt said, legitimately shocked that Iffy didn't say Silent Bob.
That was actually one of the ones on my head, but I felt like, you know, Mr. Bean probably was the people pleaser. But Silent Bob definitely...
You gotta be strategic.
Yeah.
And Drew wanted Alonzo to say the monster from Young Frankenstein. Alonzo countered, of course, that the monster from Young Frankenstein's most famous bit involves a little bit of
he sings vocal. Putting on the Ritz, so that just that felt like too much dialogue. And I went Young Frankenstein last time. I don't want you guys to think I'm a one-trick pony.
He's switching it up.
Frankenstein guy.
That's true. All right, so that's Hall of Excellence. Thanks, everybody who voted, and congratulations to Harpo Marx for being, what do we say, ascended to the rafters with the other
with jerseys? I don't know.
With who? What? With Dracula's wig?
With Dracula's wig.
How I Did It by Victor von Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember. The Batmobile, I want to say. Usually
right.
I have a list in front of me. I'll have to post that list somewhere so that everybody can admire. We need to have like a virtual hall of excellence that people can tour.
We sure do.
A VR
walkthrough. I'll work on that.
Yeah. We'll get through.
All right. Take it away for the rest of the show, Iffy.
Thanks, Marissa.
All right. Thank you once again, Marissa, for being you. All right. Now it is time for a question from the hotline. David from Wisconsin. Wow. We were just talking about you.
Hey, David. How are you doing?
Right. Iffy, reading this in a cute little fairy voice would rock my world. Okay. All right. Well, if I'm going to rock your world, let me see.
I'm so tense right now, Alonzo. So tense.
Holding my breath.
Maximum Film is great, but what about Minimum Film? We see all these films pushing 3 hours, but what about the movies that tell a complete and amazing story in 45 minutes, or even 30, or 10, or 5? What are some short films that stand toe-to-toe with feature lengths as all-time favorite best movie? Keep speaking of films, David from Wesley, Wisconsin-y.
I've sensed the fairy wings.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's West Dallas, by the
West
way.
West Lee is what fairies call it.
Okay, done.
Yeah, yeah. So
I love this question.
Yeah.
There's so many people cut their teeth as filmmakers on short films, and they should.
Yeah.
It's not an easy medium to get your 10,000 hours. It's collaborative. It's expensive. But because of that, there's so many great, innovative short films, and not everyone gets to see them. Like, obviously they're a mainstay at most film festivals, but there's not always easy access to them unless you are someone who's looking out for like the Vimeo staff pick of the week or whatever. I have a few that immediately came to mind, and many of them then went on to make features, so it's nice seeing their style evolve. I've mentioned this in the past. It's something else I love, but I think most of these are available online, if not all of them, so you can go check them out. There is a short film called Former Cult Member Hears Music for the First Time by Christopher Borgli, who had a film called Dream Scenario last year, which when you watch this short, it's the perfect example of like minimal location. It's like against one wall the whole time, and then a few people, and then it takes big narrative turns. It has a tonal switch. It's random. You're like, what all is happening here? And then if you watch Dream Scenario, you're like, yeah, of course this is what this person would dream up. Nikiatu Jusu, who had Nanny last year that we spoke about, has a great short called Suicide by Sunlight that I really liked, that takes the ideas of sort of racial barriers, vampirism, classism. Like, there's all sorts of things happening in that. And it's like 22 minutes or something. There is my friend Danny Madden has, it's partially animated and partially the world's fastest edit of so many things you'll recognize, called All Your Favorite Shows. And so the hand-drawn animation part is kind of guiding you through this character, but they're also, he's speaking in memorable visuals from movies or TV shows that you've seen. And I'm not doing a great job of describing it, so please go watch it. And then lastly, I would throw out, if you are like, you know what I'd love to see? Because this is one that I've thought about and referenced. And that's the other thing I love about shorts. I wish more people saw them, because you would also want to reference them all the time, because they're very good at pinpointing something so specific. If you are like, you know what? I'd really love to see a very realistic, awkward, sloppy, not momentarily hot, mostly awkward sex scene. There is a short called Rubber Heart by filmmaker Lizzie Bourne that is so specific and peculiar, and you're like, oh God, I've been in this moment. Even if you haven't been in that moment, you've been in that moment. And it is so realistic, but it's that thing, you're watching it and you're like, oh, she has captured so perfectly. And it's that idea of film as language, of communicating like a moment in time really specifically. And that's what short films do so well. Of a lot of, you know, they need to have a full arc to them, but so much of them are just the specificity of this little story. I love this question.
Oh, yeah.
If you've been a film festival programmer for a long enough time, you see a ton of really great shorts. And I always tell people that that's one of the more competitive slots to get at a film festival. So you should see the shorts program, because if they're showing 8 films or 20 films or however many, like there were a good 10 times that were submitted and we're trying to get to those spots. So I was thinking back to some of the first ones that I did when I started programming in Dallas in the mid 90s. I can't find it online, but there's a film called Touch Base, directed by Tony Gilroy, starring Lily Taylor. And almost the entire movie is Lily Taylor in her cubicle, sort of like taking phone calls. It's kind of a precursor to Locke. And you know, she starts out very sort of like it's another day and she's on top of it and blah, blah, blah. But there's one person that she can't track down, a friend of hers. And, you know, she's you get the sense as it's like 20 minutes long, but she goes this complete arc to being like so desperate and frantic by the end of it, of just like trying to find this person and where are they? And they build all of that with her never leaving the cubicle is really amazing. You know, the animator Don Hertzfeld, who, you know, I think has a real cult following now for his features, started out in shorts. And Billy's Balloon is a wonderfully darkly comic, and I think pairs well with The Red Balloon, which is sort of like everybody yes. knows, like the short film that everybody saw at some point, you know, which is, and if you haven't, it's on the Criterion Channel and it's gorgeous. And then just to throw this one out there as far as like what to do with very limited means but great creativity, there's a film from 10 years ago, premiered at Sundance, we screened it at Outfest, called Cruising Electric. And basically, it's a fake commercial for a like kids like auto racing set based on the movie Cruising. And it's brilliant. And it's on YouTube. You should check it out.
Billy's Balloon played at the very first Slam Dance that I worked at when I was like just an intern. Like Don was one of the first filmmakers I met. And that's like a career. Please go look up all of Don Hertzfeld's shorts. They are each increasingly like incredible.
Yeah, the first festival that I did in Dallas, it's funny because you know they do a big shorts competition, and you know it's a lengthy process, and you know there's that first day where the jury first gathers, and literally the first tape that I grabbed randomly and shoved into the machine was a short called Lily and Jim, and that won the competition, and that was one of Don Hertzfeld's first shorts.
Yeah.
Robert, I bet you have some good ones.
Yeah. There was Pillars, which premiered at Sundance a few years ago. I think Sundance 2018? Can't remember now. It's one of those 2 years. But I think 2019. From Hayley Elizabeth Anderson, which is this great coming of age short about a kind of like young black girl having this like sexual awakening and dealing with her homophobic father. That reminded me of quite a bit of Pariah. Elizabeth Anderson now has a film of feature length called Tenderberry that just premiered at this past Sundance, which is amazing. Let's see, it's also Charlotte Wells, her short Blue Christmas, which was shot by Robbie Ryan, who did Poor Things and has done a few other great films. And that one, I guess, set on Christmas Eve in the 60s in a kind of like Scottish kind of coastal town. And it follows a debt collector who's like literally on Christmas, who's like going around and trying to collect debts as his like wife is like going, it's basically spiraling at home. And I just think that's, I remember seeing that film for the first time and thinking like, oh my God, who's this filmmaker? I can't wait to see whatever they do with their feature. And of course, like 4 years later, Charlotte Wells had After Sun. Those are the first two that really come to mind immediately. But there's so many, so many great short films. And I always feel terrible when I'm at a film festival and I can't catch the shorts block. There's been a couple of times where I've kind of like tricked an outlet into making me do a quick kind of like, oh, let me do kind of just the highlights kind of piece, you know. And it's always been wonderful.
Yeah. And then, mine, there is the one that like jumped to the top of my head the moment I like read this, which is going to be Bernard Bredow's Yearbook. It's an animated short. It is like such a like concise, beautiful story, top to bottom. It gives you everything you need in like 5 minutes. You know, it's like so good. And, you know, the long and short of it is it's someone who is hired. There's a comet that's going to hit the Earth and kill everyone. And someone is hired to try and archive all the history of the world into a hard drive so that, you know, it can be carried off to the with the people who are going to escape the planet in space. I feel like that's all you need to know, because
and it's online and animated. We showed that at LA Film Fest too.
It's
like 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to drop the link so that Marissa could just add it in the show notes, because yeah, it's only 5 minutes. I think it's worth watching, and man, you only need 5 minutes to cry. You only need 5 minutes to cry. That's the t-shirt for the next Max Drive. Well, thank you so much, David. That was an amazing question, and it seems like everyone had fun with it. So great job. And look, if you have a hotline question, you can type it up or record a voice memo and email it to MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org, or you can go to MaximumFun.org/hotline and record it there. Thank you in advance. Apparently, Marissa said that we had a whole bunch kind of come in after a single, you know, dry-ass phone banks comment. So, yeah, that's the last time you'll hear it for now. Now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all.
I'll go.
Yeah.
I have it's really been a theme today, the whole Sundance. I'm sorry. I apologize for any Sundance themes. But there is a movie finally coming out called I Saw the TV Glow, which I think is something so great. And people should check out, if you didn't see Jane, is it Schoenberg? Schoenberg?
Schoenbrunn, I'm saying her name right.
Schoenbrunn. Sorry about your German name, Jane. But yeah, it's coming out. Keep an eye out. You'll love it. It's inventive. It's unique. Check it out. I saw the TV glow.
I suspect it's going to be the topic of a future episode.
Ooh.
Maybe?
Ooh.
Just wondering.
Yeah.
This film also premiered at Sundance, but let's not get into that. It's from 2000, and it's one of my favorite films about life in government housing. And it is Jim McKay's Our Song, which starred a very young Kerry Washington, among others. And it's just a beautifully crafted story about three teenage girls living in the projects in Brooklyn. They're all part of the Jackie Robinson Steppers Marching Band, which is a real thing that a lot of people are involved with in Brooklyn. And it's just this lovely kind of coming of age film about three girls in high school who are sort of at that cusp of figuring out what they're going to be and who they're going to be. And it's just really sensitive and beautiful. And it's the first film I ever saw that gives the possessory credit to every single person who worked on it. So the first thing you see in the film is a film by, and then in tiny print, all the names that will be in the credits at the in the front and back of the movie. So kudos to that. But yeah, it's just it's a lovely, lovely movie.
Yeah, I mean, but in a few days at MoMA, Museum of Moving Images, they're doing a Hiroshi Shimizu retrospective. And while much of it will be at MoMA, I do want to highlight one title that I only recently saw because Mariah E. Gates was like, this is one of my all-time favorite movies, and it's Mr. Thank You. Which is streaming on Criterion Channel, and is this great film set in 1936 about this group of random people who are all on this one bus, and they're going through the hill, through the mountains, and each person has their own kind of story, and it really reminded me of, like, Spike Lee's Get on the Bus, in the sense of, like I said, all these people with different stories, different backgrounds, coming together and kind of finding and making their own community while also dealing with heavy subjects, whether it's like bodily autonomy or it's, you know, financial independence or what have you. But I just thought the film was incredible. And I hope people either, if they have a chance to go to MoMA or go to Japan Society, which is also doing some of the screenings of the Shimizu. If you can't do that, then go on Criterion Channel, catch Mr. Thank You.
Yes. For me, I'm just going to, you know, bounce off of Journey's great performance here and, you know, throw it to a classic and say that I'm going to recommend, you know, a Denzel Washington directed film, The Great Debaters, which a young journey is in that film. Check it out. Look, Denzel said, look, I'm going to do it all. that's me.
I thought you were going to say Eve's Bayou, but I will accept The Great
Debaters. All right. Well, thanks to Robert Daniels. Where can our listeners keep up with your work?
You can follow me on the artist formerly known as Twitter, X, at 812 Film Reviews. You can also follow me, a lot of my writing, at rogerebert.com, where I'm associate editor, and at the New York Times, where I'm a contributor in my monthly action streaming column, where I pick 5 action movies that are streaming that you should check out.
Nice.
Yes. It's so funny, too, because, you know, we followed each other from the last time you were on, and like, I'll forget because it doesn't say your name. Like, I'll always see the 812 Film Reviews first. I'm like, who is this guy dropping these banger takes? And then I'm like, oh, okay. I met him. So that's me saying that is a great follow. You won't be disappointed. It'll always be something insightful and just a fresh, amazing take on cinema. But also, speaking of fresh, amazing takes on cinema, thank you, Dre and Alonzo, for another wonderful show. Yes, you know, you're going to hear us talk about Bentonville and the books. If you're nearby, you should definitely try and get to Bentonville. Or look, they got the online screenings too, so you don't even have to be nearby. And as far as books, you know where to get them. Okay, so go get yourself a book. Get the audiobook, because you know this is like, because you're already trained to respond to Alonzo's voice, so it'll feel like home. If you have
listen to it at whatever speed you listen to this program.
If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels that are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we'll be talking about challenges. It's going to be hot and heavy. And our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.